It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We joyfully receive for ourselves and others the blessings of community, sexuality, marriage, and the family. We commit ourselves to the rights of men, women, children, youth, young adults, the aging, and people with disabilities, to improvement of the quality of life, to the rights and dignity of all persons. We dedicate ourselves to peace throughout the world, to the rule of justice and law among nations, and to individual freedom for all people of the world.
In such times, business as usual simply will not get our business done.
Open doors means you're just willing to take your time and do all these wonderful things to help other people.
We have to make sure that people without a prayer have one.
We will always believe in the present and final triumph of God's Word in human affairs and gladly accept our commission to manifest the life of the gospel in the world. The United Methodist Church. 50 years of transforming the world.
Sandy Rios with you. We are going to be talking about one of the most foundational denominations of the United States of America, and that was called Methodism, founded by two British brothers, John Wesley and his brother Charles. It has one of the richest histories and has impact on this nation in ways that you probably wouldn't know. And so we're going to talk about that because the United Methodist Church is once again finding themselves in crisis, as are so many other denominations right now. It matters to all evangelicals. They are our brothers. We are all branches of the same root. And what happens with United Methodists will have tremendous impact on all of us who claim Jesus as Lord and Word of God as our sole guide for life and for the future. Mark Tooley is the president of the Institute for Religion and Democracy. His roots go deep in Methodism, and I've asked him to join us this morning to talk about what's happening in the United Methodist Church. Mark, thanks for joining me.
Hey, great to be with you.
You know what? Let's put this, first of all, in a nutshell. There is a special conference. You usually have one every 4 years. A special conference has been called for February 23rd to the 26th of this year. Why? Why a special conference?
Well, the United Methodist Church, which is the third largest denomination in America, has been debating sexuality since 1972. And supposedly, this specially called General Conference will resolve that debate by coming to a final conclusion.
All right. So, and how do you think that could you say that members of the United Methodist Church know about this conference, aren't engaged, at least concerned about it?
Unfortunately, probably most church members do not know about it. Probably just the well-informed church members know about it. The politics and policies of the denomination, and I think this is true for other denominations, usually are not well-known by the even the actively church-going members.
So who's attending this?
There are about 850 delegates from around the world who were elected locally who will serve at this general conference.
But can anyone attend? Like, will you be there?
Anyone can attend as an observer and as a guest. And yes, I've gone to, as an observer to every general conference since 1992.
So what's at stake here? I mean, from your perspective, what's at stake?
Well, almost all of the other old liberal mainline Protestant denominations in America have officially liberalized on sexuality, allowing for same-sex marriage and for actively homosexual persons to serve as clergy. The United Methodists have never done so and officially prohibit both. And so there's this huge dichotomy. Is the United Methodist Church going to continue on as a historically liberal Protestant American denomination, or is it going to become much more of an Orthodox, even evangelical global denomination? And United Methodism is different from the other mainline churches because its membership is global, and about 45% of its members live in Africa. Others are in the Philippines, and some are in Europe. And with the fast rate of church growth in Africa, the Africans will outnumber America and United Methodists probably in the next 5 to 10 years, if not before.
Which is so interesting. And I want us to talk about that more fully in a little bit. But Mark, I'd kind of like to go back in time a little bit, because as with American history, and really Methodism is kind of intertwined with American history, people really are ignorant of what things stand for and what the real roots of meaning are. We've lost so much. And certainly, as I said in my introduction, Methodism has such an incredibly rich history. The stories that surround the founding of your denomination are just spellbinding to me. In fact, I recently read a biography of John Wesley again, just loving it. And so I'd love to have a little history lesson from you. I want to sit at your feet for a second and ask you to tell us about the roots of Methodism. I suppose, well, let's just start with John and Charles. Can you tell us? I guess it does start there, right?
Yes, it does. Of course, the Wesley brothers were the key founders of Methodism in Great Britain in the early to mid-1700s. Both were ordained in the Church of England and never left it, never intended for Methodism to be more than a renewal movement within the Church of England. But American Methodism eventually broke off and formed its own denomination. And then the same happened in England after the Wesleys died. But what the Wesleys did profoundly shaped Christianity, first in Britain and then America and then around the world, by developing this new movement of spiritual vitality focused on the Bible, focused on Jesus Christ, and focused on preaching the gospel to regular people. And John Wesley became famous and controversial for preaching outdoors in open fields when the churches would now not allow him in their pulpits.
Oh, my, yes. The brutality shown to John Wesley was just amazing. As he would go around on his horse, as you said, they wouldn't allow him to preach in regular churches, and he was beaten and, I mean, nearly, you know, was hungry and could not, just never gave up. He just continued to preach. I think, you know, all these great stories, Mark, of, I think it was the Wesley brothers, I think it was John, who preached for the miners, the coal miners, because he came to the United States to preach, and probably in Great Britain he preached to the coal miners too, but out of those coal miners, especially in Wales, came these great hymns penned by Charles Wesley. Could you just say a word about that?
Yes, Charles Wesley, John's brother, was one of the great hymn writers in the history of Christianity, and again, wrote hymns that could be sung by regular people. And a lot of the emerging laboring and working classes of 1700s England didn't go to church, didn't know anything about church, did not feel welcome there. And so the Wesley brothers took the gospel to them rather than expecting them to come to church.
You know, I have to say, in order for people to appreciate this, you have to let me dig in for a second. I think of 4,000 tongues to sing. You know, 4,000 tongues to sing our blessed Redeemer's praise. Yeah, and also Arise My Soul, and Can It Be, which was a hymn that certainly the Free Church in America sings all the time. Love that hymn. Come Thou Long-Expected Jesus. I just wanted people to understand, the lyrics to these songs are deeply biblical, theologically sound, And it has really shaped, I think, the thinking of modern American evangelicals. I also want to point out, Mark, that Charles and John were from a huge family. Was it 13, 16 kids, something like that? And their mother, Susanna Wesley, they had a very, very hard upbringing, very poor, but she was faithful to teach them the word. She was the spiritual guide in that family. It's just an incredible story. So do you know how John Wesley made his way to America, what the genesis of that was?
Well, he briefly came to America as a very young man. He went to Georgia, and he regarded his brief time there as a ministerial failure. He left under a cloud of controversy and did not get along with the rulers of Georgia, and had a sort of a imbroglio with a young woman in Georgia whom he was interested in, and she ended up marrying somebody else. And from John Wesley's account, he did not feel like he was a fully converted Christian at that point of his ministry, and did not fully convert until a later experience in London when he got back.
So that must be the genesis of what used to be very unique when I was growing up about the United Methodist doctrine, and that was the whole notion of the second blessing. Say a word about that, if you could, Mark.
Well, there's always been a focus on the need to be born again, and historic Methodism, often forgot by modern liberal Methodism, and also the Wesleys emphasize the importance of holiness and sanctification, and they believe that both were accessible to all believers.
So that was, I think, you know, there are many Wesleyan universities now, really fine places, Mark, as I think about it. I think of Oklahoma Wesleyan. That's the one that comes to my mind in this moment. Really strong, powerfully biblical. So the United Methodist Church has ended up with a mixed bag, which is part of the breach here. But I want to continue with the history here for a second. So 50 years ago or so, the Methodist churches, the various and various denominations shed their other titles, like the Evangelical United Brethren, and became one church called United Methodists. Can you say more about that and why that happened?
Yes, in 1968, what had been called the Methodist Church merged with another denomination with some similar historical roots called the Evangelical United Brethren Church, and it was much smaller. The Methodist Church that was back in the 1960s, 10 million members, and the Evangelical United Brethren were under 1 million, but they merged together in 1968 to become the United Methodist Church, and that's when the spiral in church membership really took off after that 1968 merger, so that United Methodism has lost 4 million members in the U.S. Over the last 50 years. Although more gaining much more than that in Africa.
You know, here's the thing, Mark. From my vantage point, I remember watching this because I'm from a very small town. So I had friends that were Evangelical United Brethren, and I had friends that were United Methodists. I remember when the merger happened. And then I remember when that beautiful Methodist church on the corner of Main and Church Street started going left in terms of their teaching. It was just a mystery. I'd like to speak more about that. We're going to run out of time in this segment, but in fact, there's the music. So I'm going to pause because I want to ask you what the genesis of the leftward lunge was. What happened to the Methodists, who started out with such orthodox views of Scripture and had such a rich biblical heritage, and had really, the founders had given everything. These were incredible, uncanny men of God, who were the founders of Methodism. What happened in the 60s to change all of that? My guest is Mark Tooley. He's the president of the Institute for Religion and Democracy, and we'll be right back after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We are this morning.
gathered together from all over the world and from all sorts and conditions of men to celebrate a birthday, our birthday, as the United Methodist Church.
That was Dr. Albert Outler in 1968 at this conference celebrating the unity of the United Methodist Church, which at that time was 10 million strong and had just combined with the Evangelical United Brethren Church to form the United Methodist. Mark Tooley is my guest. He's a longtime Methodist. He's the president in Washington, D.C. of the Institute for Religion and Democracy, which, by the way, is doing such great work. You heard Chelson Vaccari with me just a few weeks ago talking about millennials and how to reach them. It's a biblically sound organization that tracks what's happening around the world in terms of Christian persecution and all kinds of things. But many of the inner circle, including Mark at the Institute for Religion and Democracy, have a long history with the United Methodists, and they have been tracking the degeneration of that denomination for a couple of decades now. Mark, no doubt in the 1960s, when there began to be a decline, and you've already described that United Methodists lost 4 million members pretty quickly after that 1968 merger. That, of course, what the merger wasn't the problem. It was, with pretty good authority, the drift away from biblical teaching. Who and what did that? How did that happen?
Well, it goes much farther back than most people imagine. Most people think Methodism got liberal in their own lifetimes or relatively recent years, but not true. It really began in the 1890s with the other mainline Protestant churches. The seminaries became revisionist and influenced by the German school of higher criticism, which had a low view of the authority of scriptures, if any view at all. And by the 1920s, Methodism seminaries and the seminaries of all the mainline churches had become firmly liberal. And so by the 1960s, all of the clergy over the previous 40 years would have been indoctrinated in that theological liberalism. And the decline for Methodism really began in 1965, and Methodism has lost members every year since 1965. So it's been 53 years, going on 54, of continuous downward spiral.
You know,
in the U.S.
Yeah, in the U.S. Yes, and we're gonna get to the global part in a minute. But from my own personal experience, I had a Methodist choir, youth choir, in 1974, in Charleston, Illinois, where at Eastern Illinois University, and I decided to volunteer to teach Vacation Bible School. And this was 1974, Mark. I remember the curriculum was all about environmentalism. There were no, to my memory, there was no scripture or any, there was no Bible stories. It was all about environmentalism, which was, that was like very unfamiliar territory to someone like me at that time. And then I also remember, because I conducted the choir, I wasn't a member of the church, but of course I would attend when my choir would sing. There was a series on the teachings of Mao from the pulpit of that church. This is how radical, at least my experience, was in the United Methodist Church long ago. And, of course, then the intersection with the World Council of Churches, and I have to mention that we know now that Hillary Clinton cut her teeth in the United Methodist Church. Her youth pastor was a radical leftist. I wonder if you'd want to say something about that.
Yes. Well, I, even as a boy in the 1970s, like you, I noticed how political the Sunday school materials were becoming. And then as a teenager and young man in the 1980s, I became more and more active in my local church and in Methodist politics, and became aware of how Methodism in its upper reaches was very enmeshed in what was called liberation theology, which believed that Marxist revolution offered the best opportunity to help the poor around the world. And so Methodism and other mainline churches were actively supporting Marxist revolutionary movements in the Third World, which is just amazing and incredible to contemplate. That's what motivated my own entrance into working for the renewal of the United Methodist Church, because I knew that most church members certainly did not believe in abandoning the traditional gospel in favor of a radical political agenda.
You know, I have to say, it really is a tribute to the good, deep teaching of the Methodist Church that the fight has gone on this long. Because I know, Mark, people in the Methodist Church who have fought, stayed in and just fought and fought and fought and stood their ground. When I look at, I'd like to get into that for a second, in a minute, the social principles and your book of discipline, it's still pretty solid. And I also would bring to your attention that when I was on the radio in Chicago in the mid-1990s, this sounds so quaint now, but gambling was still controversial. You know, and I learned in that moment, and I'm sure you know the man's name who it escapes me in the moment, but he was a United Methodist who was the biggest foe of expansion of gambling and brought to my attention that the United Methodists had been the ones historically and currently then fighting gambling more than any other denomination. What can you say about that?
Well, opposing gambling used to be one of Methodism's great causes, and Methodism still officially opposes gambling, but is largely, sadly, silent on the issue. But Methodism, as part of its views of holiness and sanctification, was dating back to the 19th century, very socially and politically active and working for a more righteous society. And, of course, temperance was a leading Methodist cause, and prohibition, the ultimate outlawing of the sale of alcoholic beverages in America, was largely a Methodist project, and prohibition was overturned in the early 1930s. Methodism's political activism really lurched to the left and took on lots of other dubious causes.
You know, it was Tom Gray. I know it was Tom, but I couldn't remember. I just looked at Tom Gray.
Yeah,
used to be a very, very dear friend of mine, and he was on my show a lot. And honestly, Mark, I learned I would never have understood why gambling is so dangerous if it hadn't been for Tom. And he drew from the history of the Methodist Church. He talked about how there have been two major waves of gambling in the United States and what devastation they caused to families. The loss of homes, of security, destitute women and children. He taught me a ton about that. But, of course, again, as I said, that's a kind of a quaint issue now, isn't it? Because we're dealing with things now that seem even so much more odious. So through the decades since the 68 merger, how would you describe what's unfolded in the Methodist Church? How would you kind of characterize the metamorphosis?
Well, the theological liberalism and radicalism accelerated in the 1960s and 1970s until the 1980s, as I mentioned. The enmeshment with the Marxist revolution, even violent revolution. But at the same time, and this shows how God works, the modern evangelical renewal movement within Methodism began in the 1960s and gradually grew in strength. And so by the 1980s, you had a growing effort to bring back Wesleyan beliefs and Christian orthodoxy, and that's been ongoing for the last 30 years to the point that, for example, at the 2016 General Conference, United Methodism officially revoked its support for Roe v. Wade, the 1973 abortion decision that the church had supported from the start, and also withdrew itself from a notorious abortion rights religious coalition that the denomination had helped to found in 1973. And so Methodism has become more pro-life and also has been reaffirming its support for traditional teachings on marriage and sexuality.
Yeah, it's amazing. Actually, I find myself honestly somewhat in a bit of wonder at the way that deeply biblically sound Methodists have been able to stop, at least slow down, and dig their heels in and reverse so many of the bad decisions. I have to also point out that our founder, the founder of the American Family Association, Reverend Don Wildman, was a United Methodist preacher from Mississippi. This very brilliant Southern preacher who I had the privilege of working with in Washington for a number of years, I'm sure made his mark. As I'm thinking, Mark, of this and your social principles, here's one that has been deleted recently, and it was a phrase that said, United Methodists must be aware that the mass media often undermine the truths of Christianity by promoting permissive lifestyles and detailing acts of graphic violence. There's more to it than that, but they actually deleted that in the social, your social principles doctrine. And I see the hand of Don Weidelman on that, don't you? I'm not removing it on the
perhaps I had forgotten about that particular phraseology, but every now and then something good will slip into our book of resolutions or the social principles.
Yeah, well, that's the one that was deleted, though. My point is that that was deleted recently in whichever process. You guys have, as many churches do, a D.C. lobbying branch. The Baptists have the ERLC, Evangelical Religious Liberty Commission, and you guys have something called the General Board of Church and Society. Describe that, if you would, how that works with the denomination.
Yes, as you say, that is the lobby arm of the denomination based, as it has been for 100 years, in the Methodist building on Capitol Hill, very prominently placed across from the U.S. Capitol and the U.S. Supreme Court, and other liberal mainline denominations have their lobby offices in that Methodist building, as do other liberal religious advocacy groups. And so it's been prominent for many, many decades, unfailingly liberal in its politics and not representative of the denomination as a whole. But I am hopeful that as the denomination continues to evolve and when the lobby board is reformed so that the growing African membership actually have representation, fair representation on its board, it once again will be reclaimed so that it represents the whole church.
All right, so let's come back to the special conference, which is taking place February 23rd through the 26th. That's coming right up. That's the 2019. It's called. It's not the normal conference. And you said at the top of the show this is all about issues of sexuality. So can you sort of flesh that out for us? What's going to be discussed?
Well, the focus across, usually a general conference meets for 10 arduous days. This one will just be 3 days and with only one agenda item, focusing on the church's teaching and policy about sexuality, particularly homosexuality. And so there are three major proposals before this general conference. One is liberal, one is conservative, and one is sort of in between. And I'm hopeful that the conservative proposal called the traditional plan will be passed. And I'm pretty confident that the liberal one called the one church plan will be defeated as it has been in past years.
You think it will be?
Yes, it's been defeated in past years, and there is a conservative majority of delegates at the General Conference. I think the liberals, when they realize they don't have the vote, so they will try to prevent any vote and try to prevent the conservative traditional plan from coming to a vote.
Now, Mark, let me see if I get correct me if I get this wrong. I understand that there's a rewrite of what you call social principles or your book of discipline. I'm assuming that comes up for a vote in 2020?
The social principles are a preamble to our book of discipline, sort of outlining. They're not legally binding like the rest of the book of discipline. They're just sort of outlining views and policies that the church has towards politics and society. And they tend to be on the liberal side, of course, but they are a redrafting or a rewriting of them is scheduled for the next general conference in the year 2020.
Okay, let me give people an idea of the kinds of things that the left side of your denomination are talking about. Just an overview here. It's characterizing families, declaring that no family configuration, this is what they want to move to, declaring that no family configuration is more significant than another, talks about how attitudes and practices that deny the call of any person, which is, of course, the foundation for, and that's the language used by other denominations to ordain homosexually active clergy. It also declares that discrimination based on gender identity is sin. And this is an analysis done on by one of your staff members, Mark, so I don't expect you to know all the details of it, but I'm just paraphrasing what he's written here. He says, interestingly, the only thing in 36 pages that the GBCS, and that's the General Board of Church and Society, Rewhite, identifies as sin, the only thing they call sin is a failure to accept the claims of transgender activists and ideology. It also wants to change the denomination's definition of marriage, deletes a statement saying that sexual relations where one or both partners are promiscuous are beyond the parameters of acceptable Christian behavior and ultimately destructive. They want to get rid of that phrase. And it goes on and on. So you give the idea of the kinds of details that are at stake, at least in this particular, is in 2020. But I'm sure some of that will be discussed in this February 23rd through the 26th General Conference. Mark Tooley is our guest. He's the president of the Institute for Religion and Democracy in Washington, D.C. Mark has written an article about seven steps for United Methodism's future. We want to talk about that when we return. And how does this relate to you and me? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
This comes as a survey by the Pew Research Center found that the number of people in the U.S. who don't identify with any organized religion is growing and the number of Christians is declining. So the hope is that these ads will show the church can offer more opportunities than people may realize.
One, two, ready, go!
As members of the Brentwood United Methodist Church's youth choir prepare for their next performance, numbers show nationwide the number of Christian young adults is declining. But now a new ad campaign aims to change that.
We think church is more than a place to go on Sunday. We think church can happen anywhere.
The United Methodist Church's latest Rethink Church ad campaign hopes to redefine what a church can be.
We need to remind people of how we're relevant to their lives, and the church is sometimes shifting in ways that are traditional as well as non-traditional.
The ads focus on how church can happen outside the walls of a building through community outreach. The ads were shot at four Nashville area churches and feature local members like David Sublime.
For me, my part in this commercial is the role the church plays with global hunger and addressing that and how people can go out and be part of addressing that.
While living in an orphanage in Uganda, David benefited from the work of church ministries and hopes the ads show opportunities church can present for members.
Church is about love, is about grace, is about community, is about the neighbor.
These are places where if you're interested in making a difference in the world, these are faith communities where you can do that.
Do the chorus before.
Church leaders hope more young adults take advantage.
One, two, upper voices, go.
And join churches in Brentwood and across the country.
Good job, good job.
It was News Channel 5 out of Nashville, and you hear, well, the United Methodist, you've probably seen their commercials in the last several years trying to reinvigorate their denomination and also spiritual life in the country. Mark Tooley, who is the United Methodist, is the president of the Institute for Religion and Democracy. If you just joined us, we're talking about a special conference that's been called for United Methodists February 23rd to the 26th. And the point of this conference by the left is to alter traditional biblical United Methodist doctrine on sexuality to something different, which would mean, of course, I'm guessing, Mark, the embrace of transgenderism and same-sex relationships and ordaining homosexual priests, pastors. Am I correct to say that?
Yes, this has been the main battle flag issue within Methodism for over 45 years, homosexuality. So a church law prohibits ordination to anyone who is sexually active outside of marriage between man and woman, and church policy officially disapproves of any extramarital activity, including homosexual behavior, and describes homosexual behavior as incompatible with Christian teaching.
Thank goodness, because it is. So, Mark, the interesting wrinkle here that you have alluded to is that the Methodist Church has become, I hate to use this word because it brings on other thoughts, but it's a global church, meaning it has a membership that includes, this reminds me of a Episcopalian church who have such a strong, vibrant Orthodox membership in Africa, and really you could argue it's probably played a part in reviving parts of the Episcopalian church. So you guys have the same thing. You have a strong growth. In fact, what percentage would you say of the worldwide United Methodist denomination are in Africa?
Well, it's different from the Episcopal Church. The Episcopal Church is an almost entirely U.S. Body, but it belongs to a global Anglican community.
Anglican, an informal gathering
of autonomous national churches that has no juridical authority over the Episcopal Church. The United Methodist Church is itself international, and so of the 12 million members, over 5 million are in Africa, and there are 6.8 million in the U.S., and then smaller numbers in the Philippines and Europe.
So how did that happen? Does the United Methodist Church still actively support missions?
It does, but the churches in Africa are so strong and large, they're doing quite well. I appreciate any help that the U.S. Church can give them, but they're doing quite well on their own, and United Methodism in Africa is growing by about 150 or 200,000 members every year, while the church in the U.S. declines by close to 100,000 members every year.
Okay, so what would you say is the distinctive difference between the African Methodist Church and the American Methodist Church?
Well, the church in Africa is overwhelmingly conservative, biblical, evangelistic. There's no debate over sexuality for the church in Africa. It's about winning souls and changing lives. So the church in Africa resembles what Methodism would have been in America in the early 19th century.
Isn't that interesting? Really, Mark, I just think that's so interesting because, you know, you've seen, now I'm going to branch out a second, but when I was president of CWA and we worked at the UN, one observation we had was it was these third world countries where people were, not necessarily speaking biblical terms, but they were, for the most part, probably Christians. They held fast to moral principles at the UN when the Western countries like Canada, America's feminists, Canada's feminists were railing against, you know, for women's equality, the promulgation of abortion, probably lesbianism at the time, even so. And it was the third world countries who were putting their foot down and saying no. I just think it's refreshing, actually. It's sort of like God's sense of humor. We poured so much of our mission dollars into evangelizing these difficult parts of the world, and the seed was planted, and it took. And their role in the world has been to say, "No, you're not going there." So that's what's happening to your church now, don't you think? I mean, because if it weren't for the Black African Methodists, do you think things would be different?
Oh yes, if it weren't for our African membership. The United Methodist Church would be where the Episcopal Church is and the Presbyterian Church USA and all of the other liberalizing and much faster declining liberal mainline denominations in America. So the African United Methodists literally are saving the United Methodist Church.
Yeah, isn't that something? That's really something. That actually gives me chills. Only God could orchestrate something like that.
Right.
All right, so you wrote an article recently where you laid out what you feel are seven steps that could take United Methodism into the future in a healthy way. So let's talk about those. You say that the United Methodism must retain its biblical stance on marriage and sexuality. Why not just let those that don't believe in it in their congregations do their own thing? Why is it important that the denomination be consistent as a whole on this?
Well, every denomination in the world that has liberalized on sex is declining, if not dying. And the only growing denominations in America and around the world are those that have upheld a biblical teaching on sexuality. So even if you don't care about what the Bible has to say, purely from pragmatics, if you want a vibrant, growing church, you have to keep the teaching orthodox.
You also say that the sexuality battle shouldn't be localized. What does that mean?
Well, the liberals, as they have in the past, are pushing for to overturn the denomination-wide prohibition on same-sex marriage and want to allow local churches to make up their own mind, which is what all the other mainline liberal denominations did. And, of course, the impact was disastrous in terms of precipitating schisms and accelerated membership loss. And, of course, when you localize the battle, you just end up dividing local churches.
You know, this is one thing I don't know the answer to this. With the Episcopal Church, I'll start here. With Baptist churches, the local church owns their facilities, pays their pastor, calls their pastor independently. I know that with the United Methodist Church, you guys place pastors, right? The congregations don't search and call. But then what does that mean in regard to your buildings and property? Do they belong to the local church or to the denomination's central offices?
If the property is for United Methodists, as was true for the Episcopal Church and the Evangelical Lutherans and the Presbyterian Church USA, are owned by the denomination, not by the congregation.
All right, so what happens then if, I'm guessing that if there should be a split, then you've got all of those property concerns, the Episcopals, you know, Episcopalians. I remember that, the beautiful church in, is it Falls Church in Alexandria? Such a gorgeous, gorgeous building, was taken away by the liberals, tiny liberal faction of the Episcopal Church, and the evangelicals who really outpopulated them in that congregation had to find another place to go. Is that what's going to happen to United Methodists?
No, because, of course, the liberals took over the Episcopal Church and won the sexuality battle, so the conservatives had to leave and typically lost their buildings. In the United Methodist Church, conservatives are in the emerging majority, and so the traditional plan that conservatives are supporting at this special general conference would allow liberals to leave with their property if they so choose.
So they could take their church building? Like if a church was mostly liberal, you say, let them have their church building and property?
Yes, if they couldn't abide by the church's teaching on sexuality, they would have that ability.
So in other words, a local church would take a poll, take a vote, to see if the majority of that particular congregation was conservative or liberal or wanted to leave the denomination? Is that how that would work?
Or the region, the state church or the region. So, for example, United Methodism in what's called the Western Jurisdiction, which is the West Coast and the Rocky Mountain State, very, very liberal. So potentially that whole region could quit the United Methodist Church and form its own new liberal denomination.
And that would include, you've got some great seminaries, or at least they've got great facilities. They used to be great. And universities. So that would include them, too?
Potentially other institutions could leave and create or join a new denomination. So United Methodism has 13 official seminaries, and they're almost all liberal. So it would be very interesting to see how that would break down.
You know, I'm going to move ahead to your sixth point. And we talked about this. You call this one Rediscover Wesleyan Riches. We talked about that. And, you know, I think you're right. So, but you say, what do you mean by that?
Well, this is not just a Methodist problem. As denominationalism dies or recedes in America, the great Protestant traditions are gradually being forgotten. And the growth area in American Christianity is non-denominational Christianity. So typically young Christians, young evangelicals in particular, have no loyalty or even knowledge about the great Protestant traditions. And they're just they're generic evangelicals, and there are pluses and minuses to that, but they're not very rooted in history or tradition. I think that's a great and tremendous loss. And so I think that the renewal of the United Methodist Church definitely requires a rediscovery of the riches of the Wesleyan tradition dating back almost 300 years.
You know, I have to say, because I'm a musician, I so miss the great choral music, which I think Methodist Church is still, you guys still have choirs and organs, don't you, pretty much?
Yes, we do, generally.
Yeah. I miss that so much. And I think that part of, I'll speak more broadly, the evangelical church, Mark, we have lost so much of our history. And by that, I don't mean just history for history's sake. I mean doctrines of the faith, deep and profound worship that were folded in to those great hymns. We've just thrown them out as though they have no worth at all. That in itself needs to be folded back in, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think increasingly a number of millennial of Christians are moving in that direction and wanting liturgy and some of the great hymns and something a lot richer and deeper than just sort of generic evangelicalism for all its strengths too often lacks.
Yeah, we have such a great history, and of course this is what's happening with Europe. Europe is coming apart in various ways because they have lost the foundations of their greatness in Western civilization, which really was rooted in being people of the book. And I'm talking about the Holy Bible, Jesus is Lord, the teachings of Christ. It's what made and founded and made Western civilization flourish. And they have forgotten their beginnings, and we don't want to follow with that. So that's why what's happening in the United Methodist Church matters to all of us. For those of you in the denomination, that conference is February 23rd through the 26th. And we'll put Mark Tooley's article on our Facebook page so that you can read about those seven steps for United Methodism's future. Mark Tooley, president of the IRD. Thanks, Mark. Thank you for your time today. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.